And I can't tell which you're arguing when you say at least put it in up when you're around residential area. So will you clarify that part?
Yes, Your Honor. The evidence in this case clearly demonstrates that Houston Lighting and Power woefully inadequate in the projects of what they have undertaken in terms of public education. They've got a three-pronged duty here, as I see it. To warn individuals that they know are going to be in a particular situation where the hazard is going to present itself, backyard, subdivision. Secondly, they can place warning signs in these high-density areas on the lines or on the poles themselves. But thirdly, and of equal importance, is they have a duty and an obligation to educate the public. And they have woefully failed in that duty. Out of a public relations budget of $2 million, they spent $40,000 on public education. There are a lot of ways to get the message to the public. Television media, radio, newspaper, none of that was done. Mr. Secrets, who is the advertising manager for Houston Lighting and Power, and I just mentioned this, Houston Lighting and Power reaches 90 to 95% of their customers 8 to 10 times a year. None of these television spots where they were reaching 90 to 95% of their customers 8 to 10 times a year ever mentioned once the hazards and dangers of utility installation. This is Jack Thompson's testimony. He's an engineer.
Mr. Hardy, just not trying to tell you what to do. We have read the brief. We are aware of the evidence in the case. Not that anything you're saying is not helpful to us. We can always be helped by any argument. But we are more familiar with the facts, I think, at this point than we are of the legal questions that have been raised.
From a products liability standpoint, this case was developed with the view in mind that electricity is a product, and most other jurisdictions have so held. The question basically was, when does the sale occur, or when is it in the stream of commerce? It's in the stream of commerce when it is somehow, some way, released to the public, and this court has so held. This case was tried, it was pled and proved on a marketing defect theory. We proved that it is in the stream of commerce at the time it leaves that generating plant. We prove that the dangers inherent in the product are foreseeable to Houston Lighting and Power. We prove that the public at large has a very minimal level of understanding of the dangers of these utility lines through their backyard. Counsel for HL&P can criticize those inquiries we made in that poll. But that's all they can do is criticize those inquiries, because never once have they ever conducted such a poll themselves to try to determine that level of understanding of the public at large. It is a hazardous product. They had a duty to warn. They failed in that duty, and the jury so found. And we're not asking this court to plow new ground. I think if you take the proof in this case and apply it to existing precedent in this state, the conclusion is absolute.
Thank you. One question, Mr. Hardy. Mr. Pitts made the point that you're talking about 35,000 volts as opposed to 110 volts. Now, you say the product was in the stream of commerce. What is your response to the fact that it is actually altered? It's a raw product in the transition line and the finished product when it gets past the meter.
It's not offered, Judge. The electricity is the same as the electricity that goes in the lateral. There's no difference in the electricity, whether it's 35,000 volts or 110 volts. All they do is lower the amperage.
I believe, Mr.
The product's the same.
I disagree with you on that.
It's a policy decision that this court is faced with, and I submit to the court that it's that these areas of proof that we have offered in this case distinguishes this case from no other that has ever been tried in any other jurisdiction, let alone this state.
Thank you, Mr. Hardy. Mr. Bonder?
Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court, I'm reminded of the story of Professor Silas Ragsdale, who in Rockport had the young lawyer consume all of his time in opening argument and was told to sit down after 4 minutes. He was still talking about Robert E. Lee. So I suppose I don't have time. I had prepared what to me had some logic to it with respect to a brief of the argument, and if I could be permitted to file that within the day, and they can make what response it at least brings up to date some recent authorities.
Just hit whether it fits the product liability case or a negligence case first, Mr. Trump.
Yes, Your Honor, and that to me is the thing I wanted to spend time on. This is a mixed bag. It's much like watching your mother-in-law drive your new Cadillac over the cliff. I would like to have a clean cut shot at Brooks where it doesn't interrelate to the liability under a strict liability concept, because if we're correct about strict liability, then the court is not required to face Brooks. And yet if we talk too much about Brooks, it may be sort of like Mr. Tipps is seductively suggesting, come on, let's modify Brooks a little bit, but leave strict product liability alone in terms of this area. So it's a hard thing to argue with that on balance. But on the question of strict, there seems to me to be no question in the cases in the last 10 years that this is a product, whether it's in the transmission lines or in transformers. There seems to be no question that in Texas, due to Armstrong Tire versus Ortiz and some civil appeals opinions, I guess I've got to sit down, but there seems to be no question that under Ortiz that we're in the stream of commerce. Apart from policy considerations, this has been sold, it is consumed, it can't be recaptured, and it's gone once it leaves the plant, and it's generated the power, the consumptive power is generated by the demand. Everybody has got some electrical appliance and drawn it at any given time.
Would you reply to the punitive damage argument that was made?
Can I say one more thing, what Judge Spears said about warnings? When you read, and I'm sure you have, the opinion of the first court, they distinguish warnings as applied to negligence and the duty to warn as applied to strict liability, and apply this rather harsh test that seems to be so offensive to the utilities. Namely, if you know it and you know others don't know it, you've got duties commensurate with communicating the risk, as in Alm versus Alcoa. In that line of case, you've got to do your best job to get it to them. Now, putting the outer limits on that, Judge Spears, is awful difficult things to say, but when you're talking about distributing within consumer neighborhoods and in their residential lots, you've got to be a damn up Dudley Do-Right and a Ralston straight shooter to meet the test this court has announced of warning in products cases. Now, the policy overlay, man, I've learned for many years, don't discuss policy with the court. They knows its policy and what it's going to do. Mr. Chief.
Just a minute. We're trying. I realize the difficulty everybody's in. Judge Campbell has called to my attention that what time of day did Mr. Hardy start speaking?
I'm not sure. They had a one or one thing at 12 minutes.
It's time again at 10:08, unquestionably.
That's correct. Would you agree with that, counsel?
Yes, sir.
There's some difference here.
Yes.
I mean, it's kind of like a basketball game where the clock's got to be. We certainly don't want anybody to take more than their time. We're very careful about that in this court, but neither do we want somebody to have less than their time. Now, let's just stop on my time here for a minute and decide how much time the respondent still has. Judge Campbell, who's a good note taker and careful watcher of watch clock, says that you started at 10:08. Is there any disagreement of that?
No.
All right, then, Mr. Condo, you've got about 7 more minutes.
Probably ought to have taken it the other way, Judge. I may do more damage in this 7 minutes if I sat down. But I appreciate the indulgence of the court, and thank you very much. As at least we perceive it, independent of the policy considerations, they are in the case, sure. But the warning, the type of warning that could be given, there are 2 aspects of warning. Whether it should be given, and 2, how can it be effectively given. And those, it seems to me, are in the area of the inquiry the court is making. I say that this young man, the testimony showed, was aware because of signs on these big old things we all see out on the highway, big derricks that go up and carrying power, they say danger, high voltage, you stay away. He was aware of what that meant as compared with what an in-lot, in-house program might mean. Warnings to the people. Neither of these parents of the home he was visiting in knew of these risks either. I'm not going to fall back totally on technical chemical versus Jacobs and say to the non-warner, it's up to you, pal, we could have read it, you can't, it's presumed we would have read it. But the facts remain that nobody did know it, they strung these lines with knowledge they were going to do it in this subdivision. And there are certainly many more things this proof shows that could have brought knowledge home. It's certainly to the parents, to the family itself. In moving, I know that's not, it's hard to compress that, Judge, in the light of the record. But I do want to mention, if I can, the points with respect to the denial of a generic contrib issue as applied to this. If the court reexamines its language in the Duncan 2, it will observe that the part that it said remaining issues, comparative fault, in all 3 of the cases cited from out of state, Pulaski and Bush and these cases which this court cited in that decision, very clearly support what the Court of Appeals had and the district court did. Namely, you've got a different breed of comparative fault. There has to be some evidence of knowledge and appreciation of the risk ascertained either by an issue or instructions. I can only say that a friend at the University of Texas who filed a vociferous amicus curiae on the front side of this has recently written exactly what I'm suggesting to the court, and I would like to furnish those most recent authorities on the comparative side.
That now, was saved in Duncan, too.
Yes, that's our position, Your Honor. And that the case is
your position is that it was not in this case because it didn't rise above the exception that Duncan 2 carved out. That's to say there was no proper issue served up on it.
That is correct. We say that there was not properly tendered, there was no instruction given that would put it at the level of the comparative fault that this court.
Mr. York may want to reply to that. It hadn't gotten involved yet.
And
I
do.
Disagreement over that or not. Is there any disagreement over your point dealing with jury strikes?
Well, there is between us, but not, I hope not between us, the court and us. I hope I'm zigging when the court's zagging right. I didn't do it very good in Smithwick.
What is the short answer to that complaint?
About the jury strikes?
Yeah.
Our position is there's absolutely no demonstrated antagonism or adversity between the 2 defendants under the pleadings, at the time of the voir dire, and at the time the challenges were supposed to be exercised. There's no antagonism in any way, as this court announced in Garcia and Lopez. and I assume reconfirmed in Smithwick. I had a little trouble with the digestive tract, but that's still in all. It's relevant, particularly as it shows how quick things can turn and hit you. That sort of helps us here. But while the judge said they could consult together, he did not require that. And there's no proof that any strikes exercised by the tent company were given to Mr. Hardy to exercise. There's zero proof. Now, obviously, their arguments are full of surmise, suspicion, and castigatory kind of allegations we lawyers make towards one another. But on the proof in the record, there is no proof that these people erroneously sat on the jury or there was a materially unfair trial under the test of any of these trilogy of cases this court has recently announced. I think more important to attack is women jurors. It permitted too many women jurors to serve and they're empathetic with a boy with his legs and one arm blown off. I say to the court that this verdict doesn't manifest that to my mind.
Well, and who you strike with is not involved in Garcia.
That's good. And he did not, there is no proof in this record that he agreed to give or struck anybody suggested by the plaintiff, Mr. Chief Justice. But I believe the record...
What about the punitive damage?
Yes, sir. Now, let me... try as I might, it seems to me this is an attempt to re-argue the applicability of Sheffield versus Jones. And that if there is some care demonstrated in the record, there can't be gross neglect. I'm misreading Burke and Krauss and Cameron and Clifton and Winchester and Dyson if that's not true. What I thought the court did, and what I more accurately hope the court did, was to say that on these questions, gross, or any exemplary, or any of these things, you look at the testimony in the record most favorable to that finding. And we don't and are not bound by defensive testimony, which is highly controversial and contradictory.
Help me with this. How do you make a distinction between a case of this bad old negligence? One is punitive in nature, one is where there is a conscious decision not to care. How are we going to have the law in this state where Burke tried to put it? We just want to get those cases where there's absolute, decided, conscious indifference and distinguish those from cases where there's just bad negligence involved, or what we call a darn good liability case.
Well, Your Honor, that may be asking me to count how many angels can stand on a pinpoint. But what I will say is that, first, take the premise that I perceive Burke and the progeny to be talking about, is that the no-evidence aspect of this question, that is, gross or reckless conduct, is determined as with respect to any other issue. You disregard the unfavorable testimony and look at the testimony, because we aren't dealing with sufficiency here. We're dealing purely with no evidence. The second aspect that you address yourself specifically to, as you know, is generating large volumes of smoke and fire across the street from you. And I can only say that probably, to my mind, Dyson versus Olin comes the very closest to describing the type of mental conduct that is necessary to sustain the finding in the substantive sense. And it does have to get up a little bit over a super neg or some kind of a thing that's just normal bad conduct. And the recklessness definition and the conscious this requires, as the court said in Dyson, a state of mind. And what you must look for in this record, was there a conscious state of mind with respect to the conduct of the power company towards people in the position, the unwitting, the unknowing? And we think this is, in this case, Mr. Chief Justice, in spades. I'm talking a conscious, deliberate, intentional desire not to spend the dollars or take the time to communicate what can be the most disastrous kind of risk that any of us can ever encounter. Thank you for the additional time.
Mr. Ward?
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. If I may, I'd like to talk for a moment about the jury strike issue, which has not been gone into much today. We believe strongly that the case should be reversed on that point because there was a collaboration and an exchange of cooperation in the exercise of strikes between the plaintiff and the tent company defendant, which was really only sort of a straw man defendant. There's never been a deposition throughout the case taken of anybody with the tent company. No other discovery directed to them that I'm aware of.
Let me see if I've got the facts straight in the record, counsel.
Did
you concede before the striking was to take place that it should be six for the plaintiff and six between you and the tent company?
Yes.
All right. And did you anticipate striking with the tent company lawyer?
Yes. We said so in the pretrial. We said, can we strike together? And the court said, of course. We don't, I may not have fully answered, but we don't think that the question of was there any antagonism between us and the tent company makes any difference. That is a test, as it was in the case that the Chief Justice wrote to Garcia. I think they were talking about, was there enough antagonism to justify more strikes for the defendant than the plaintiff got. In our case, there was no antagonism. Let me just say that. We said it below. We'll say it here. There's no antagonism on any issue that got to the jury. Of course, the tent company got dismissed out before they got very far. They got dismissed after the opening statement. But the point would be, even if there was antagonism, let's suppose that the court said, well, I believe there is antagonism, and I'll give four strikes to HLMP and four to the tent company, and only six to the plaintiff. Even then, if they'd then collaborated on their strikes so that the plaintiff collaborated with the tent company and exercised the strikes, we'd still have a problem of unfairness under Rule 233, unfairness to any litigant. We have almost the exact situation that was in the Diamond Shamrock versus Wendt case that this court NRE'd a few weeks ago, the Bull case from Corpus Christi. The vice is in the collaboration. What we say should happen is that the court
They said in Wendt that there was a misallocation of the strike.
That's right.
I don't hear that being argued here, that there was a misallocation of the strike. The argument seems to be that the guy you were going to strike with ran out on you and struck with the other people.
And there's no sicker feeling, as Your Honor
knows.
What law
can we hang our hat on to give you some relief?
On Wendt, on Diamond Shamrock versus Wendt, because the other cases that the court has primarily looked at have been ones where you're talking about allocating among defendants and a question about antagonism and everything. Judge Certain in the Wendt case, NRE'd by this court, said, well, we're going to align the defendants together. We're not going to try to align them with the plaintiff. But even after having done that, we noticed that they consulted, that they did look at jury profiles together, and that they in effect struck together. And that's not fair because it gives an advantage. There were 13 women and 10 men on this jury panel. There was one double strike. That's why it adds up to 23. The jury wound up being 11 women and one man. That wasn't what we were after. It was what they were after. Now they had a hearing. And they said, "Well, we struck it. We this is in the record. We asked counsel for the tent company. Okay, we've got our strikes. Now let's go over." And they said, "Well, we've already struck with the plaintiff. We've already consulted with the plaintiff." So we raised all that with the court, and we even had a hearing with the court and discussed it. They took the position that, well, while they struck in the same room, that the tent company really struck only what he considered to be jurors that would be bad for him, even though he struck in the same room and consulted with the plaintiff. That kind of really what I would call game playing by lawyers is the kind of thing that Judge Spears spoke so strongly about in the dissent in the recent Scurlock case. It was on Mary Carter agreements there, but it's the same different words here, but the same music. It's just one of those things where you're not getting a level playing field. For them to say that, well, we struck in the same room, it'd be like a fella finding his wife, if you permit this way of expressing it, in a hotel room with a strange man in a state of undress, and they say, well, we really weren't collaborating, honey. It's just that the circumstances speak so much more loudly than any story that can be told by any of the participants.
How do we stop collaboration?
Well, I think if in this case, what we did when we found out that it happened was go to the judge before we turned in our strikes. And we said, Judge, or maybe we'd handed them to the clerk, but we had not seen their strikes, they'd not seen our strikes, and the jury panel was still there. And we said, Judge, they have struck in the same room with each other. And we want you to give us some more strikes so we can get the people off that we want. And we still have the jury panel. All we have to do is give us some more strikes and equalize it, and we're in business. That would have done it. I think that any time it is brought to the attention of the court prior to the time, at least prior to the time the jury panel that you've been picking from, has been discharged, and it's still practical to do it.
Then when that wasn't done, you moved for mistrial.
We moved for mistrial.
That's when you had your hearing, and that's when Jay Hurst, the temp lawyer, testified that he didn't do anything to collaborate with him. He just sat in the room with him.
He said they discussed some jurors, and he claims he struck a prison guard. He's a defendant in a case where he struck a prison guard and a Gulf supervisor and a Texaco geologist because he thought they were bad.
Well, assuming they collaborate.
What can we do under the law? What can we do under the law about it?
Sorry, Mr. York.
Yes, sir. When you went to the judge and told him that there you suspected collaboration, had there been more than 26 jurors voir dired at that point?
I believe that there...
I mean, your list shows 20... I don't... I suppose you put this up.
Yes, sir.
Your list shows 26 on here, and you were saying, give me more strikes, more peremptories. Had a sufficient number of people been voir dired at that point that would have allowed you additional peremptories?
Yes, sir. There was a large jury panel. We had lost some people off of it, but...
Well, I don't know how they're doing now. When I was on the bench, you know, I'd stop them when we got up to how many ever were under consideration and say, you don't need to go further.
We had talked to a number of them. I'll be honest with you, I can't absolutely recall whether the court stopped us at 26, as we often did in Harris County, or whether they said, well, go ahead and ask. It certainly the general question, there were enough people there to accomplish it without putting the trial off. Whether or not they'd all been interrogated, I frankly can't remember.
What other points do you want to touch on?
Well, I'll just take a minute on question of the way the issue was submitted, whether or not the failure to guard should have been appropriate or not. This court had before it a case argued that Keene versus Strick or something, I believe, a month or so ago that had some of that in it. First of all, I want to make clear that our position on that is not that the comment or the portion of Duncan 2 that reserved that little thing about McKesson and comment in. We're not saying that that ought to be overruled or taken out of the law. What we're simply saying is that if a trial court looks at the evidence and concludes from the evidence that the only form of negligence that's there on the part of the plaintiff is what would amount only to a failure to guard against the defect or a failure to discover the defect, then in that instance the court should not submit an issue on contrive or comparative. But that if the court believes that there is, let's say, a mixture of a failure to discover the defect and other conduct which would itself standing alone be negligent or would be the subject of an issue, that the court should submit the issue, and he should submit it without the language of any kind of exclusionary instructions. It is our position that failure to guard kinds of things are no different than any other kind of conduct which does not amount to negligence. If you had an automobile case and let's say the plaintiff had failed to wear a seatbelt and you had a contrib issue on him for driving too fast or something, the court would not normally instruct the jury that while they were asked about negligence, they should not consider wearing a seatbelt or should not consider some other kind of conduct that does not arise to the level of negligence. To add a bunch of language to these things, it seems to us, is a retreat from the idea that the court very rightly had in Duncan, that is, that we simplify these things. I remember old Dave Prager from Beaumont telling me a story one time about a jury case he tried over there, an old assumption of the risk case where they had the know and appreciate issue, and he lost it representing the defendant. I asked one of the jurors, said, how in the world could you rule against me on that case? You knew that guy knew all about that thing. And the juror said, well, we knew that he knew about it, yes, but after it hurt him so bad, we just didn't think he appreciated it. If you add language to one of these things.
What issue did you try to get?
Well, in this case, what we wanted was what we wanted and what we submitted was the issue suggested in Duncan. Just the pure comparative issue suggested in Duncan without this instruction. This instruction had not been suggested by any case. The pattern jury charge that suggested it hadn't come out, didn't come out for a year. It was never argued on that basis to the trial court. I mean, no one suggested there was anything wrong with it. In our view, we didn't waive it. It's our view that this was something that that wasn't in the law, and that in any event, the limiting instruction should be the plaintiff's burden to bring up, and not the burden of the defendant. I might say one thing very quickly on gross negligence that in reference to your question, Mr. Chief Justice, of what sort of an angel dancing on the head of a pin issue, if you contemplate the fact that the Court of Appeals in this case found, as a matter of law, that there was no ordinary negligence. No ordinary negligence, but then held that there was gross negligence. That is a, it's, if you tell people on the street that, it's something only lawyers can deal with. But it, to me, for a group of learned justices like the Houston Judge Coleman's court, to conclude, to read the record in such a way and be able to come to the conclusion that there was no ordinary negligence, suggests to me that there's a, that it would, you'd have to, with any logic at all, conclude that it would have to be at least a real close question as to whether or not there's any gross negligence.
Mr. York,
yes, sir.
Is there any way they could justify those punitive damages on the product liability side without having to get into gross negligence?
I think you could. That, I mean, that's a fair comment and fair point. You could do that. Well, when I say that, I don't mean to say we concede they, you know, should have had gross negligence and all that. But if you just left out the ordinary and I just didn't even submit that, then the comment that I just made, of course, couldn't be made. That logic would not follow. You obviously can have gross negligence in a strict liability case.
How do you understand Judge Coleman's rationale if there was no evidence of negligence?
Well, I think he was just going by the Brooks opinion in the 1960 Brooks case, which Mr. Hardy says is archaic. It was a construction job in Houston, I believe, where they're building a building next to a power line, which is what we have every day. And they just simply said that there was no evidence that the light company knew that there was any activity going on or had any particular knowledge that would lead them to believe that they needed to give a warning to this particular person. And I think that was, generally speaking, what Judge Coleman went off on.
Are y'all trying to suggest in your argument that this maybe ought to be handled as a negligence case?
Yes, sir. I think we're saying that if anything, that's what it is. I know that the court, you know, our strongest position as advocates would be to say that you just shouldn't have to give a warning for any of this. But if the court came to us and said, well, look, we don't buy that. We think we ought to, we've got to do something about warnings here. Then I think what we would say is, rather than try to push and shove and pooch and scooch and get products liability worked over here to a point where it might work on us somehow, that there's a much easier, more direct way for the court to do it. Not one we approve of, but if the court just asks us, not as advocates, just say, look, we need to figure out something. Now, you guys help us and don't try to kid us. Just tell us something. That's what we would say. Now, I don't know whether that answers the court's question very well or not.
If we did that, what would we then do? Send it back? Or we modify Brooks and send it back?
Well, I guess
rule for you, or what?
The result would be that, of course, there is a jury verdict on negligence, which stands. If you knocked out products liability, and if you said the Court of Appeals was wrong on Brooks, then it would be there'd be a trial judgment which could stand on negligence. You would have to answer the other questions about credit. All these things about credit, the one thing that the writ was not granted on was the credit issue. That really doesn't come up unless you get rid of products and go back to negligence. You have some other issues to answer about credit and what kind of judgment to write, but essentially it'd be you could do that.
Y'all didn't bring us an easy one, did you?
No.
We'll take a break.
Y'all, please rise.